BBC in Naples,
Tel Aviv,
Perth, Accra.
Wherever you are, you're with the BBC.
You're listening to KPFT, Houston 90.1 FM.
Kevin Varga is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he will be dead. This is Execution Watch. Texas has given up public hangings, but stay with us as we witness the legal homicide of Kevin Varga by lethal injection in Huntsville, death penalty capital of the Western world. Execution Watch host Otis McClay, legal analyst Jim Skelton, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Dennis Longmire, Louisville Vigil reporter Lavette Ulichny, and special guest Sandrine Skinner, French wife of Texas death row prisoner Hank Skinner, whose case is pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. The Execution Watch begins.
Good evening, and I think the second most important piece of information is that I'm not Ray Hill. It's Otis McClay sitting in for Ray, who is actually doing an event at a prison. Do you know where he is?
No, I was asking.
Oh, Elizabeth knows. Ray will be here tomorrow night as we have another execution, and this, I always find this to be a very strange show, that we're sitting here and talking about somebody who is being legally killed by the state of Texas in our name, as though doing that would somehow have some effect on crime. So far, how many executions have we had, Jim? Something like
500 or 600.
500 or 600 since it was reinstituted, and it doesn't seem to have stopped crime.
No.
That doesn't seem to have done much. Tonight, this is a case, actually, tonight and tomorrow night, the man who's being executed tonight and the man tomorrow night were both convicted in the same crime, which is Dennis with us? Okay, and Elizabeth is now going to put him on the phone. Dennis.
Hello, is this Otis?
Yeah, hi, how are you?
I guess I'm well. I'm standing on the corner with 11 other people.
And you're up in Huntsville in front of the walls, right?
Yes, at the walls unit. We just watched the witnesses for Kevin Varga enter the building. A couple of minutes prior to that, witnesses for the media had gone in, which is a signal to us on the corner that the execution is taking place on schedule.
Right. Right, and of course, everybody has to go in separately, and they're all in three separate rooms. Were there any other witnesses, victim-type witnesses?
We would not know that.
They go in another entrance.
They started keeping the family members of the victims in the walls unit before 5 o'clock, so I don't really know whether there are any witnesses for the family members of the victim.
Yeah, it's kind of strange. You would think they'd make it a public execution, you know, so that...
You know, if they want to have the effect that they claim they want to have,
right,
you would think they would proudly publish this and make it as public as possible. But we do it in Texas very, very quietly and very secretly, which suggests to me that somebody really knows that it's a sin.
Right. I guess if people saw a few... after the French Revolution...
Yes.
When all of the people went, placidly to the guillotine?
Absolutely.
Until Madame du Barry.
Absolutely.
Who screamed.
It shocked them.
Right, and it shocked people so much that was kind of the end of that whole second reign of terror.
Yes.
All right.
Some people believe that might happen again, but today's population, and maybe particularly America, I think it would become a reality television show, and we would have more of them rather than fewer.
Right, getting people to feel... No, I don't even want to think about it. I don't even want to think about it. All right, Dennis, we'll be back to you later with your report. Thanks a lot for being there and for, you know, being a witness.
Thank you for your work.
And I'm here. We're in the studio here at KPFT with our producer, Elizabeth Stein, and Jim Skelton. And Jim... Let's talk about the case.
Well, as you'd mentioned earlier, this guy Kevin Varga really was from South Dakota. And he and a guy by the name of Billy John Galloway. And each of them had respective girlfriends. And of the entire four people, all of them were either on parole or probation, including the girls. In fact, Varga's girlfriend was only 17 years old, really a young gal. And what happened, they decided they were going to go to Mexico. And so what happened, they take off in Galloway's car, and they don't have any money to speak of. And they get as far as Wichita, Kansas. And when they get to Wichita, Kansas, they need money. And they did perhaps one of the oldest ploys that people have ever done. They used the women as bait to get men to come back to the motel. So what happened, the two girls went to a nightclub, and they lured a guy by the name of David McCoy to come back to the motel. And what their initial plan was to blackmail him. I mean, how they're going to do it, I don't know, other than the fact that he was going to, I presume, have sex with the girls and is going to blackmail him, make him. Anyway, what happened, they bring this guy, David McCoy, back to the motel. Varga's hiding in the bathroom, and he comes running out of the bathroom with a piece of pipe. And the two girls left the room, and they heard a bunch of thuds. And Galloway and Varga together beat the man to death. They beat him with a piece of pipe. They beat him with a ball-peen hammer. They kicked him, and they stomped him, and they killed him. And after they killed him, they stole what he had, stole his car, put his body in the back of Galloway's car, and they leave in Galloway's car as well as David McCoy's car. And then they troop off from there, and along the way, Galloway's car breaks down, and they abandon it and leave the body inside of a parking lot, and all of them jump into the car that had been owned by David McCoy. And then they end up in Greenville, Texas. Apparently, they were on their way to Mexico. And in Greenville, Texas, they needed money again. They decided to do the same thing. They would use the two girls as bait to lure men to go with the two girls, and they were going to rob and roll them. That's kind of a thing they had been doing. So what happened, the two girls take a guy by the name of David Logie, L-O-G-I-E, and they met him at a motel and convinced him to go eat supper with them. And when they leave the motel, they are driving his rental car because they're going to guide him back, and they get to drive off out in the woods. In the meantime, Varga and John and Billy John Galloway are following in a car. They get him out in the woods, and they do the same thing to him. They attack him and beat him to death. And they use also the same sort of technique. They beat him with sticks. They beat him with clubs. They beat him to death and stole his credit card, stole all of his money, and again stole his car. Logie was driving a rental car. And at that time, they set fire to the car they had gotten from David McCoy, and they left in the rental car, which is really foolish because once they left in the rental car, people are going to have that, you know, listed as a stolen vehicle. And so what happened, they end up in San Antonio driving this stolen rental car. And in San Antonio, the two girls used the credit cards of David Logan going on a big shopping spree. And these two brilliant people, Kevin Varga and Billy John Galloway, end up in a strip club, of course, using credit cards to buy drinks for the girls. And when San Antonio, a policeman pulls in behind the car after all four of them are in it, well, just the two girls were in because they were on a shopping trip, they pull in behind the car and stop the car because it was stolen. And when they stop the car, the 17-year-old girl by the name of, her name was Venus Joy Anderson. That was Varga's girlfriend. She pretty readily confessed to everything that occurred. She told the police pretty much everything.
You mean right there?
Yeah. And I've often told people this, and I've told them time and time again, that the most dangerous person that a defendant has in a murder case is a girlfriend or a wife, because they always talk. They somehow just can't keep their mouth shut for whatever reason that happens to be. And after she kind of spilled the beans on everybody, then, of course, they arrested both Galloway and they arrested Varga. And that's how the case broke, and they took him back to Greenville. Both of them were indicted. Both Galloway and both Varga have gotten the death sentence. Varga's scheduled to die now, and tomorrow night, Galloway, the guy that was with him, is scheduled to die. And what happened at the trial, how they made the case, neither of the two men confessed. Both of them were on parole. The two girls were on probation. And during the trial, what happened is the state offered immunity to Venus Joy Anderson, who is Varga's girlfriend. They gave her immunity, and she told the entire story about how they lured men back to the motel in Kansas, told her about both murders. And there was not much of a way to defend this case, and after he was found guilty, they introduced a lot of pretty bad, not really bad evidence, but typical evidence. Apparently, Varga had been getting in trouble since the age of 10.
Now, you said he was on parole in South Dakota?
Out of South Dakota.
Uh-huh.
And he had been on trouble since the age of 10. His mother apparently, well, not apparently, she admits this. His mother is a single parent. She was an alcoholic and apparently was a pretty big booze hound. And so he started getting in trouble at the age of 10, ended up in juvenile reform school, ends up in the penitentiary, did a stretch for theft, did a stretch for burglary. And then he is also, all that evidence came in during the punishment hearing. Additionally, there was evidence that he had been abusing his wife, because he has also two young boys that now, one of them is 18, one of them is 21 by now.
I was going to ask, when did this take place?
The murder took place in, the murder took place on September the 7th, 1998.
Okay.
So it's been quite a while.
14 years, yeah.
And his two boys now, respectively, 18 and 21 years of age. In fact, they're supposedly traveled down from South Dakota to be with their father during the execution. Whether they made it or not, I don't know. And what happened during the punishment hearing, they introduced evidence that while he was in jail in Texas, which is Hunt County up in Greenville, he tried to escape. They introduced evidence that when he was in prison in South Dakota, he was one of the most violent offenders and apparently was in a lot of trouble, always bullying and abusing the other inmates. And they introduced that evidence. Plus, there was evidence they went to his house before he left town in South Dakota. When all of them left, he wrote a bunch of stuff about killing and death is coming and muster on the wall. Plus, he went by the wife's ex-house and scratched out her driver's license photograph and wrote death or something on it. Apparently, she had a protective order. And he put the classic FU across the protective order. And, of course, all of that evidence came out. So the jury had evidence of two pretty brutal murders, beating people with hammers and clubs and robbing people. Had evidence of them stealing their cars afterwards. They had evidence of this is a person who's been in trouble since the age of 10. And evidence they'd been violent toward his wife and beat up his wife, and they had no problem giving the death penalty. When the case went up on appeal, there really weren't many issues at all to argue about because they had a co-defendant who testified.
How long was the trial? A couple questions. How long was the trial, and were the two tried together, or were they tried separately?
They were tried separately.
Yeah. Two different trials.
Okay. And it's ironical that both of them, of course, I think after the cases were respectively affirmed, the issues were pretty much the same. The trials were almost mirror trials because they had the same girl testifying in both cases. And I think the judge is the one that sets the sentence, the execution date. And I think he did it just for the sport of it, had one die the next day and one after the other. And so what happened on the appellate
same
process...
Same judge, both trials.
The only big issue in this case they brought up on the appeal was they had discharged a juror. They struck a juror for cause that was what we would call a vacillating juror, had real, real strong feelings morally against the death penalty, but bounced back and forth whether or not she could follow the law. And that was one of the major issues on appeal. And then argued the law is ineffective for not taking this up on appeal. And the courts, both the Fifth Circuit as both the Court of Criminal Appeals, saying the judge was within his discretion of dismissing that juror, because when a juror gives you two different answers, they say, yes, I can, and yes, I can't, as long as there's some evidence they could not assess the death penalty regardless of the facts, they can be challenged for cause. And that was one of the major issues on appeal, and that usually never works because judges are fairly careful nowadays.
So, I mean, they had used all the reject for cause, and it was okay.
Didn't say. All they're just simply saying is that the judge granted a challenge for cause made by the state, and they thought it was error to do so. And they thought the lady should be able to stay on the jury panel. But since she vacillated back and forth, they said she had strong moral feelings but some ambivalent feelings about following the law. Therefore, the judge was justified in striking her. And the only issue that's come up since then, and they've parted and gotten the parole board on this, and what they're trying to say, and this is kind of interesting and somewhat unique, their claim that he may have a form of mental retardation caused by his mother being an alcoholic, and that's what they've taken before the parole board, that during her pregnancy she was still drinking and was a binge drinker.
Fetal alcohol.
And they were talking about him having some sort of mental retardation, but the problem is They've given him a series of IQ tests, and in one IQ test, he scored 126, which is rather bright. And even the appellate lawyer said there's no hope of him being found mentally retarded because his, all of his IQ tests is scored well,
some,
above.
I think there's some evidence that fetal alcohol syndrome has different effects. And, you know, if indeed such a thing exists, and apparently there is some evidence that it does, not an invented disease, and that sometimes it can make people, sociopathic.
Well, whatever it was in this particular case...
But they were just calling for retardation.
But see, that's not a defense.
Right.
You've got to be mentally retarded. You got to have an IQ of 70 or under. You got to have no adaptive skills. I mean, you can't tie your shoes or can't go to work, can't count money, have no adaptive skills. And this onset of these lack of adaptive skills and IQ has got to occur before you become an adult. In other words, there's got to be school records showing that you're retarded. And none of this evidence was ever present in his case. Of course, he was in reform school by the age of 10, so he never finished school. I mean, most of his education came by benefit of the state and barbed wire. That's how he got educated, because he never really attended many public schools by the age of 10. He's already been locked up. As a matter of fact, he's pretty much been locked up since the age of 10, either in juvenile facilities or in prisons in South Dakota. In fact, his son, who was 18, one of the sons coming down here, claimed he had never seen much of his father ever during his 18 years. His father was always locked up. But apparently they formed some sort of relationship at this time.
Well, I mean, obviously a case like this is almost, you know, impossible to appeal, because there's, when you have the kind of evidence that the woman provided, you're pretty well stuck.
And see, the thing is, what makes a case like this, at least from a lawyer viewpoint, so difficult to defend, is that it's kind of a senseless, brutal murder when you start beating people in the head with hammers and pipes and limbs and stomping them and kicking them. It's not like shooting somebody in the head. It obviously indicates that you're somewhat an extremely violent person. And they could just as easily have robbed him and stolen their stuff without having to kill him. In fact, that's what the girls thought they were initially going to do.
Yeah, it's standard badger game.
And when you start beating people to death like this, and especially as violent as this is, of course you're going to have all the...
And then do it twice.
Yeah. Because you have all the forensic evidence of brain matter on hammers and brain matter scattered everywhere because you beat somebody. It's like hitting a watermelon with a stick. And you have all that real gory forensic evidence that really impresses a jury. And especially a jury in North Texas around Greenville, Texas, which is pretty close to the Oklahoma border. They're pretty...
And these are also for guys from out of state.
Pardon me?
They're from out of state.
Yeah, plus they're convicts coming down here.
Yeah.
And none of that helps. And proving that you got an alcoholic mother is not, you know, that may be of some benefit, at least some appeal to some people. But to a jury up there, the woman also had four or five other kids. And she's also a booze hound. And they didn't get into trouble. And so, but he did. And apparently he's always been pretty much in trouble.
Yeah, the other thing is when you see that kind of behavior, and then when you, the three questions, you know, for the punishment phase, you almost have to answer them. Yeah, he's a future danger.
Because it's going to be real hard, because what's a guy going to do for a living who's been locked up since the age of 10 and on and off? I mean, he's not learning any skills. He's not going to come out being a welder or plumber or electrician or a doctor out of prison. And he was 28 years old when this occurred. And his likelihood of him ever getting some type of useful job is pretty remote. Plus, he apparently wasn't real bright from what they talked about, at least from what his mother had to say. Because his mother apparently suffered a great deal of guilt from this, because she was working for a Walmart up in South Dakota. And after he got the death penalty, she got transferred down to Texas, to Greenville, Texas, so she could be near her son. And she's been visiting him every other week. And she feels apparently a great deal of guilt because of this. And both the sons apparently were coming down. A brother's coming down, supposedly. I don't know whether they showed up or not, but they had planned to do so. And, of course, the mother, as when she got in her mid-30s, did what a lot of these boozers do. She found God, and she does no longer drinks anymore. But still, she spent 30 years as a drunken mother raising these kiddos. And that, you know, and the impact that had, society had to pay for part of it.
Yeah, the interesting thing is, I don't know if you know more than I do. We don't really know much about him, you know, except from the descriptions, of what he did and his background and so forth. Whether, say, in a more civilized society where prison was a place that focused on correction as opposed to punishment, whether he could have been turned around and, you know, become a taxpayer like the rest of us, as opposed to being someone that we pay huge amounts of money to, you know, to deal with.
He apparently, from what little I've been able to find out through newspapers and case law, was pretty much a product of our penal system. He's a product of what we produce by the way we institutionalize and treat people. And he was pretty much a product of the system. Because obviously there was a lot of anger and violence in him. And that came from only one place, and that came from what he went through as a person. Of course, he put himself there by his conduct. And
But at the age of 10, I don't know how much, you know, that's tough, because 10 is a kid.
I mean,
16 is a kid. You know, these are not formed people. And, you know, it makes you feel very righteous, you know, to say that somebody else is bad. But obviously, whatever experience he had in the reform school didn't help at all, because he came right out and, you know.
What was interesting, though, is back when Will Graves, a deceased lawyer here in Houston, I helped him with a whole bunch of death penalty cases and made a number of trips up to death row in Huntsville. And at that time, something like a fourth to a third of everybody on death row had been in our reform schools. And it just seemed to me like we were kind of raising quail for a later, bigger, more exciting hunt coming up down the road. Because we really raised the product that we later executed. Yeah. We raised them in especially our juvenile facilities. And they're getting the inclination now, as at least it's lessening some. They're trying to treat juveniles more humanely now. There's been more emphasis on rehabilitation, but, man, it's been slow in coming. Because back about 10 or 15 years ago, back when this guy was locked up, the idea then was to treat them like prisoners and, treat them harshly, punish them. As though that would deter their conduct.
Right.
And it'd be the same thing if you've got a dog that tends to bite the neighbors, and you take the dog to a veterinarian, he locks the dog up and beats the dog on a daily basis, he's going to come out and bite not only the neighbor, but probably bite you too. Is not going to make him less of a violent dog.
Yeah, one of the things about dogs like that is they're fearful, usually. A lot of those dogs are very fearful. When you find a dog who is fearful, that's a dog who is also likely to bite, especially when cornered.
Well, see, that's the only world they know, because that's how they get by, is by being violent. And it becomes a part of ingrained in their system. It's a part of their culture.
Okay, we have... We have Dennis on the phone. Dennis.
Yes.
Hi. So what happened?
As we speak, the family members of Kevin, who witnessed the execution, are walking down the steps of the Walls unit. Just before we got online with you, the two other reporters who must have been in the same witnessing area as the family members of the victims had walked out. And so the execution is over, and everybody is walking across the street. The state has once again done whatever it is we want to call this.
In our name.
In our name.
At a cost of probably more than $1 million.
At well over $1 million,
yeah.
Indeed. And that's got to resonate somewhere. Someone has to start thinking about that specific issue. If nothing else turns this around, it is absurd that we're spending this kind of money in a time when we are so desperate for educational funds and health care funds.
Well, I think there's something like five states, I think, that I've heard of, I don't know the number, who are investigating the death penalty for that very reason, because they can't afford it.
Absolutely. In fact, there's a woman here who's from Missouri, and she's actively involved in the Missouri movement against the death penalty, and their legislature is actively looking at the issue of cost. And I've always been repulsed by the idea that the money issue might actually make the difference, but I'll take anything. And so if that's what it takes.
Well, American morality today has to do with money for the most part.
And as Cyndi Lauper said, money changes everything. Maybe it'll change this.
Yeah, well, that would be something good to come out of it. Then that would put us in a kind of a cognitive dissonance.
Well,
got what we wanted, but the way we got it was kind of weird.
But the other fear is that we might start streamlining the process to save money, so that we don't have such a lengthy process, and that would increase the likelihood of innocent people being executed. And so I'm afraid of the letting the economists get a hold of this, because they'll figure out a way to do it cheaper.
Yeah, and also, you know, Holder the other day started that little thing about, well, maybe we will change the Miranda thing for terrorists.
Exactly.
But how do you know they're terrorists until you try them? But you didn't bring that one up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm going for the real morality, and hopefully there will be an awakening.
I have a question. Did you happen to notice how many family members of Vargas' family there were there?
There were supposed to be three people. Kevin's mother and two other people were supposed to witness. And I don't know who the two other people were, but I got word from someone here that told me that Kevin's mother was the only one with his family who was witnessing.
Really?
I also saw a woman named Kathy Cox, who is a member of the Salvation Army who does a chaplaincy for guys on death row, and she's witnessed dozens, if not hundreds, but she's participated in this process for a long time. She was going in with the family as well, and so I do know that there were three people who looked to me to be civilians who were witnessing the execution, and that includes Chaplain Cox. So there were at least three people witnessing for Kevin.
All right, Dennis. Well, thank you.
Okay.
Was there much of a crowd there saying hang him, by the way?
Oh, yes. There were actually 11 of us here,
No, the ones saying hang him, the ones at the other end of the street.
Oh, nobody.
Nobody, okay.
At all, which doesn't surprise me, given the physical distance between Greenville and here. And so, and we don't, as I don't know if I mentioned, but we don't ever really have much interaction or even visual sightings of anybody who might have been witnessing for the family member. Logie, I don't know how to pronounce the victim's name, but we didn't see anybody coming in on his behalf, but they may well have been there.
Okay. All right, Dennis Longmire, professor of criminal justice. Well, what is your actual specialty?
You got it, criminal justice. If there's a specialty,
yeah.
I always emphasize the criminal nature of it, because what we do in the name of justice seems to be criminal.
Right, at Sam Houston State, which cleverly overlooks the Walls unit in Huntsville. Thanks for being there, and thanks for doing this.
Thank you for what you're doing.
Thanks. Take it easy.
Okay.
All right. I guess the state wins this one. And I don't know. Do we feel any more righteous? It just seems... You know what I see? It's like... There are people who look at this is, you know, I almost want to go to biblical prophecy. You know, biblical prophecy, there's this sort of thought, well, they're telling the future. No, what they're doing is just looking at the way things work. You know, if you beat kids, then what they learn is that's how you deal with problems. If you put kids in reform school like this and you treat them badly, that's what they're going to think you're supposed to do. And so we're just prolonging this whole process and ends up costing society and everything. I mean, it's crazy. It's really crazy.
I've used this analogy a lot of times. If a hospital, when somebody's ill, goes into it and they come out more diseased and more contagion than they were when they went in, they'd close the hospital down.
No, they don't, because that's happening.
What would happen if people realize how dangerous, in fact, there was somebody I was listening to, I think, on National Public Radio, on one of these Sunday talk shows that had been in prison a long time. And he kept saying that a vast majority of people prison get out of prison eventually. And where do they go? They go back to the hometown, to the very place that sent them there. And you would think when they came back to that hometown that they'd be a better person for their experience, but that hasn't turned out to be the case.
Yeah, because... Oh, okay. Oh, we have her. Okay, Jim, hang on. We have Loveta Lichny with us. And normally at this time, we would go to the vigil, and I can't remember his name. I'm so embarrassed.
Dave Atwood,
right, who is usually here in Houston.
We're branching out.
And we're branching out. This is Elizabeth is designing the show and making it a little more elegant, which is just fine.
And Loveta is in Louisville, which is north of Dallas.
Right. And she is at St. Philip the Apostle Catholic Church there. Hi, Yvette.
Hi. How are you, Otis?
Nice. I'm going to say Lovette instead of Yvette. I will get this right. And Elizabeth said there was kind of a story about vigils there.
Well, I guess the story is we started vigils some years ago, and we tried to do them on the day of each execution in the state of Texas, but as you know, there are a lot of executions.
Yeah, I think we lead the pack.
We wore out. Well, in March of this year, Sister Helen Prejean visited our church during a parish mission, and she really fired us up again to start this up. She pointed out once again that there was such a need for this. You know, making our voices heard in Texas against the death penalty. So we have reorganized and we've changed our procedure a little bit in that we just have one service a month for, unfortunately, usually more than one execution that month. And it's just a prayerful, a peaceful, prayerful service that we do for each person that's being executed that month.
Or persons.
Go ahead.
Because it seems to be like three or four, we're kind of averaging, I guess, around three. It doesn't seem to be stopping crime, but I guess, you know.
Well, I totally agree with you. I think there's four this month. There's one tonight and one tomorrow night.
Right.
And then two more this month. So we're going strong here in Texas, that's for sure.
I'm curious about, just to kind of, I'm going to quiz you a little bit, if that's okay. How big is the parish itself, generally?
The parish is the largest, it's the largest parish in the Fort Worth Diocese. It's around 3,000 families.
How many participate in the vigil?
Well, maybe on a good day, 15.
Interesting.
The demographics of this parish are extremely conservative, like much of Texas, and so this is not something that is well attended, but we are more committed this time to educating
Do you have support?
People, you know, and so we're hoping that it is something that will grow.
Is the parish supporting you? Is the priest supporting you?
The priest is supportive. However, you know, he doesn't want to do a homily or speak about this from the pulpit. And I noticed Nancy Pelosi did ask the leadership of the Catholic Church to step up and speak about this from the podium, which we've asked a couple of times, and we've, you know, been told that that's not the demographic of our church. And
I'm sorry, that's so funny. Excuse me. I have to, like, think about that because, you know, from my point, I am not what you would call religious, but I think there's a lot of wind there. You try to shield the phone from the wind, yeah. But it seems to me that it's this kind of could be looked at as a religious issue, you know, as an example from the person that we claim to, you know, be the Son of God. I think he's kind of spoke about this. And it's so funny that it becomes a political issue when it's actually a moral or a religious issue.
And that is exactly what I thought this was with Nancy Pelosi. So, you know, I agree with you.
Yeah, it's interesting. We find things out. And it's actually very biblical. Elizabeth had something here.
Oh, right. Lovette, there was actually, last night there was a a protest in Rome outside the Colosseum against the execution of Kevin Varga, and it had the...
Oh, was there?
Right, and it had the support of the Vatican. And in fact, the Pope wrote a letter to Governor Perry last month asking him to please spare Kevin Varga's life.
Oh, wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I know that the Church has gotten more and more involved in opposing execution. So it would be interesting to see how long that takes to get to the parish level in conservative parishes like yours.
Yeah, you should get hold of that letter and, you know, kind of put it up somewhere. It's like there's a letter from the Pope.
I'm having trouble hearing you all.
Oh, I'm sorry.
There, I hear you.
I was going to say, it sounds like you're in wind there. I mean, that's...
Am I better now?
Yeah, oh, no, it's fine. But it would be interesting to see what people's response is. And it might, you know, support the priest and possibly the bishop, you know, and maybe, you know, we should be making a stand against this in liberal Catholic tradition.
Well, Levette, if you wanted to read more about the letter from the Pope, Levette, if you go to our website, which is executionwatch.org, and you go to the entry on Kevin Varga and click on back page on Kevin Varga, and you'll see a number of newspaper articles that have been on the wire, and one of them talks about his mother visiting, and in that article is coverage of the Pope's letter to Governor Perry.
Wonderful. You know, in contact with a woman that's on death row in Texas, and a friend of mine is, we're kind of walking with a couple of women on death row, and we may have the first woman executed in Texas in a long time this year. All of her appeal options were ended last week, we noticed from the article that ran in the Dallas Morning News that it was very biased. If you yourself did not check into what the true facts of the case and the whole deal was, the article was very misleading.
Interesting. I wonder why.
Who's the woman whose appeals have run out?
Pardon?
Who is the woman whose appeals have run out?
Linda McCarty.
Okay, now that's the...
McCarty.
Now, she's a British...
She's actually a British citizen.
She's a British citizen,
and
that's right.
If you look into this, it's very interesting, the situation with the judge and et cetera. I believe Bianca Jagger is, highly involved with her.
We'll see. Well, Levette Ulichny at St. Philip the Apostle Catholic Church in Louisville.
Yes.
Thank you. You know, thank you for getting the vigil back together. And I would hope that you would continue to be an example to your fellow parishioners about what Christianity teaches. Dare I say that?
Yes. Christianity in the best sense of the word.
And try not to, you know, be too proud. Retain your humility and do it, and it, you know, could be really effective. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you.
All right. And we'll speak to you again.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Very interesting. And you, how did you find her?
Well, actually, the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, on their website, there's a link to vigils held around the state.
Ah.
And some of them have phone numbers, some don't. So uh-huh. I just got on the internet and found phone numbers and talked to priests and church administrators. And by doing that, someone did refer me to Levette. So
now, did you
it.
Talk to the priest at this church?
No, it was an administrator who said, aha, you need to talk to Levette.
Ah,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Quickly push it aside. I mean, it would be interesting to talk to the priest and say, you know, is your job? I mean, is your job to have a lot of people?
That's another
know.
But this was a case I had left an email, and then she got back to me, and,
uh-huh.
or I'd left a voicemail, and I think I sent an email. So I just put out a lot of feelers, and this one happened to come back in. She got back with me.
Yeah, I mean, you think that Christian churches, given that the example that Jesus gave was, you know, not killing people and not doing things like that. And
well, also, after years of sitting on the fence, the Catholic Church does now oppose execution.
Yes,
actively. Yes.
But I'm saying, Christianity, which is, you know, a large group of people, you would think they would all be up in arms about this. And so it kind of raises some questions, you know, about current religion. And, you know, for those of you, I have read the Bible. I have studied. I went to an Episcopal school when I was a kid, which I know doesn't count in Texas. But so I actually do know something about it. And I've interviewed a number of, you know, John Spong and some other people on my show. So I have an interest in this area, and it's always a mystery to me why people who claim to be, you know, peace-oriented and so forth like to see people get killed.
Well, I think it's a mystery to a lot of people. I think we're a complete mystery to folks in Europe, where there was a vigil, or I should say a protest, against tonight's execution last night in Rome. We have another international angle tonight, and that is...
Yeah, I was going to say, you have this interview that you did.
I did an interview with the wife of a death row inmate who was lucky enough to get a stay, unlike Kevin Varga. His name is Hank Skinner. And his stay was so last minute, he was in the middle of his last meal when he heard that the execution had been stayed. Hank Skinner has proclaimed his innocence ever since he was arrested in 1993 for the murder of his girlfriend and her two adult sons. And he is suing the Gray County District Attorney in civil court in an attempt to get a hold of death scene evidence for DNA testing. And the reason he got the stay was that the Supreme Court said, okay, we want to have the chance to consider whether we'll hear that. And they're still considering whether they'll hear it. In fact...
whether DNA results should be included in the evidence.
Whether he should have the right to sue in civil court, the DA. It's about it being in civil court. It's kind of a small issue. But, I mean, the legal question is small. But it's, may he bring a civil action against a district attorney because there is some important crime scene evidence that has not been tested. And so she and I talked about that. Now, the reason we taped the interview was that for some reason she lives in France, which is 7 hours ahead of us, and she didn't want to stay up till 2 a.m. to talk to us, which is what it would have taken. So, but I was in touch with her this morning, and she said the Supreme Court has scheduled Hank's case for a conference tomorrow, and that means that there could be a decision by Monday on whether they will grant him a full hearing on that issue.
Okay.
Yeah. So, in the interview, we talked about a lot of things ranging from...
Play the interview. Yeah.
From international efforts to abolish the death penalty to how the two of them got married. Play the darn interview and be quiet. Okay. Sandrine, what sort of reaction is there to Hank's case in Europe and internationally right now?
In France, it is huge. I don't think Hank has any concept of what's going on here. I am really being harassed by the media here. I've done a number of big media. It's done primetime news, opening of primetime news, 2 days running on the 24th and 25th of March. I'm doing a live radio on a big station Wednesday morning. I'm still being followed by Canadian media, Swiss media, Greek, Portugal, England. So the case is covered very well and thoroughly, and people want to support, they want to help. The French authorities have been very supportive too. It's only thanks to them that we did get last visits and that we've got our correspondence rights back. So it's pushing, but we have to be careful about how we use international support too, because Governor Perry is running for re-election. And the strategy that we have to have in Europe, we cannot keep telling countries what they are doing wrong. We need to tell them how they could do it better. You know, and if it's just pure basic criticism, we are not going to get any results and we're not going to get anywhere. We need just to dialogue and explain of what is happening in abolitionist countries, which is now a majority of countries in the world, because 20 years ago, 51 countries were abolitionist countries, and today 139 countries are abolitionist countries, and more will abolish this year in the world. So, you know, it's a matter of time. It's not a matter of if it's going to happen. It's just a matter of when. So we have to be cautious and find a strategy that is not there to just point the finger, but to say, guys, you could do a lot more for your people, you know. And that's the way we've tried to do it here. This is how it works. look at our crime rates, you know, even if you look just at Canada, at the figure, the numbers in Canada, it's very compelling. So these people keep saying it's a deterrent. It's just, I'm sorry, but I have to laugh. It's just not working. It's not working as a deterrent.
So, Andrine, you mentioned about Governor Perry running for re-election. What sort of a strategy does that seem to require for people who are against the death penalty internationally?
Well, I have told most people who have written to him, and I did mention it to him in my letter, in the closing part of my letter, that I know that both our countries have very different perspective on the death penalty. But in fact, in Hank's case, the issue is not even death penalty, it's criminal justice. It's the basic, you know, sense of how, what is justice supposed to do. In fact, his daughter, the first question she asked me, she said, well, any CSI episode I've watched, the first thing that's being done is they test all the evidence from the crime scene. And that's the real question. Why wasn't the evidence tested by the police? It is not a question whether he waived his right to DNA testing at trial or not. It's a question, why wasn't it done anyway?
Well, that's a good question. When I look at some of the evidence that Hank's attorneys are seeking to have tested, it seems pretty major. The murder weapon, fingernail clippings, evidence that's under them,
a windbreaker
that another possible suspect was seen wearing a similar one to.
There was also a boot print in a pool of blood that is certainly hanging on boots, and it's definitely not his shoe size anyway.
What is the sense of why they were not tested? Has any credible reason been given?
There's no reason. I mean, you know as well as I do, and probably better than I do, how the appellate courts work. It's procedural loopholes just to bar the evidence from being heard, from ever having to talk about the essence of a case. And in that sense, Hank's case is not an exception. On Texas death row, there are numerous cases where people are just being given a procedural runaround forever and ever, up to the point where they've exhausted all the possible remedies, but then nobody wants to look at the evidence, and the evidence is not admissible in any court. And it's getting to a constitutional question, a serious question, as to why in the United States in the 21st century the Supreme Court can say that innocence is an issue. If you read, I think it was one of Scalia's opinion in a dissenting opinion last year, that innocence indeed is an issue, but it is not a good enough reason to reverse a death sentence.
There are a few people who disagree with that.
Absolutely, but people are not really informed that well about the appellate process. People say the appeals are too long, for example. You hear that all the time. And look at Anthony Pierce's case, who's finally gotten relief after 32 years on death row. 32 years for a court to rule that its court-appointed attorney at trial was incompetent. So, I'm sorry, the appeals are not too long.
But we interviewed.
If it applied the law, it wouldn't need to take that long.
Right. Well, we interviewed a gentleman on Execution Watch last week who'd been on death row in Arizona and was there for 21 years before a court determined that, yes, it definitely was someone else who committed the crime.
Yeah.
So you're right. You know, you mentioned that you're still being pursued by major media outlets in Europe about Hank's case, about what's happening here in the United States, here in Houston, the death penalty capital of the Western world. Yet we're not seeing much here. Is there any attention from media in the U.S.? Are you getting any calls from them?
Well, I have purposely kept away from the U.S. Media, except for you guys. and the only reason I accepted to go on Larry King is I knew they were going to talk about the case, and I just wanted to be able to correct the facts, because I knew that, you know, facts presented would be incomplete or incorrect, which was the case. So I just was there to be Hank's voice. And, you know, they just turned up that women witness out of the blue that nobody's ever heard of, that Hank does not know. That, you know, if this woman had any credibility, her statement would have been documented years ago. She would have been used by the prosecution at trial or at the evidentiary hearing.
But which woman is this?
Believe me, if there had been any report of domestic violence in Hank's home,
the police would have used it against him long before the crime.
Which woman is this?
That a show like Larry King does not double-check the background of the people he's putting on his show. Oh. All I have to say about that.
Oh, so I'm dreaming, who did he bring on?
A woman called Tara Bradley, who supposedly was a friend of Twyla. And she said she knew Hank and Twyla, and he says, well, no, I've never heard of her. I don't even know who she is. And what she's saying is pure lies. And what she's saying is pure, you know, it's her statement. There is nothing to document anything of what she's saying. In fact, we have opposite testimonies and affidavits, you know, to counter what she's saying. But, you know, what goes on live television, unfortunately, has major incidents on the public's opinion.
Mm-hmm. Well, what... How did you and Hank wind up meeting and getting married?
I'm sorry?
How did you and Hank meet and wind up deciding to get married?
We started writing in 1996. I met a young French attorney who had done his thesis on the death penalty law in Texas. And he told me at the time, you know, death row was at Ellis, and told me about the Lamp of Hope, which was run, set up, you know, from death row by death row prisoners. And he told me they had a newsletter, and he said, would you mind translating it? Then we could circulate it in French-speaking countries. And I said, yeah, it's fine. So I translated a couple, and then he gave me three names, and he said, you know, if you want to correspond with somebody over there, I think with those guys you'd get on well. And Hank was one of those three names. So that's how we started writing, and then I visited him for the first time. We visited in 2000.
So you...
Marriage was never really on the play. I have never been married before. He had been married many times. It wouldn't change anything to our relationship, but we laughed about it over the years and said maybe one day we would, but we would rather keep it for something to do in the free world. But I said to him, you know, if at some point you need it, I'll have no problem getting married. And I said to him, the only reason I would want to do it is if your appeal starts going, you know, the wrong way and going down the drain, then first of all, I want to carry your name and I want to continue this battle no matter what happens.
So when did you get married?
Well, he asked me to get married, for us to get married in May 2008 in a letter, and 2 weeks later we were banned from visiting and writing. So I had to get hold of his mom to get his birth certificate, which took longer than what we expected, and so I had to wait until I came back the following October. So we got married in October 2008.
What are you hearing from Hank? I know that when the Supreme Court issued a stay March 24th, he had already eaten his last meal and had made his peace.
He was eating his last meal, actually.
He was in the middle of it, huh?
He finished his last meal.
And how is he taking all this?
He fell over, basically. He said he saw a picture of me in the media where I was raised my arms, and he said I did the same thing. I just dropped the phone. He just, you know, he couldn't believe it. It was just a real serious roller coaster, you know, 25 minutes or 35 minutes before you're supposed to die.
And how is he handling this period now between the stay and the Supreme Court deciding whether they'll hear his case?
Well, I guess you can go to the website and look in the Death Row News sections, because I posted a new Hellhole News that he wrote on the 26th of March.
Could you give me the web address for that?
Everything is going through. And it gives a really good, a compelling, you know, example of what someone goes through, that he was sleeping a lot, he was exhausted, and he's having nightmares, and what most of the people who have been through this go through, you know.
Sandrine, what's the address for that website, please?
www.hankskinner.org.
It's .org?
Yes.
Okay. www.hankskinner. .org. Okay. And
for news sections, there are several sections, and one is called New Hellhole News. And the most recent one, which is, I believe, is number 23.
Okay, thank you. And can you tell me, just to wrap up, one of the things I think that's tough to get a perspective on here in the United States is the international view of the death penalty in general and also the view of the specific cases going on. Can you give us a snapshot of the point of view of Western Europe toward what's happening in the U.S., especially in Texas, with the death penalty and executions?
Well, the point of view is that it's very puzzling that the country that, you know, portrays itself as the leading nation in the world is the only country in the Western world still, you know, enforcing and applying the death penalty. And really, it's on the international scope of abolition, it's either going to go one way or the other. Either America will wake up and lead and abolish the death penalty, or it will be more and more isolated, as many, many countries are abolishing, and they will be left on a very short list of, you know, not very friendly states.
And what sort of, when people stop and talk to you or find out your situation, is there such thing as a typical response to what's happening here in Texas?
Well, Texas, as you know, does not have a good reputation, not just because of the death penalty, but the southern states generally, I guess because of the history of slavery. But people are very supportive. They want to know more. And I must say that all the journalists I've worked with have done their homework and have researched Hank's case, and they just say, God, my arms fell off. I can't believe it. And I say, well, where have you been for the past 15 years? When people write to you and try to get you to look into a case, of course, universally, people will say, well, every prisoner, say, is innocent. But I said, if you get information from a case in Texas or somewhere else in the United States, for that matter, you know, it's worth your time looking into it because there's a good probability there's something wrong with the case.
Sondrine Skinner, wife of Hank Skinner, who's on Texas death row and who received a stay just last month, stay of execution, and whose case is being considered by the Supreme Court, actually being considered whether the Supreme Court will hear his case. Sondrine Skinner is a chairperson for the International Committee of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, and we thank you, Sondrine, for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Not yet.
Anyway, as I mentioned before the interview, the Supreme Court is supposed to have a conference tomorrow to consider whether they will have a full hearing about Skinner's claim.
And this is restricted to that civil issue,
right,
whether or not he's allowed to sue the district attorney to include evidence, which was...
Well, to release evidence or to test evidence, crime scene evidence. And yes, he's using the civil courts because... just hasn't had any luck getting the evidence released or tested any other way.
And where did this take place?
Pampa, Texas.
This is in Pampa?
Right, Gray County. It's Gray County.
All right, well, this is Execution Watch here. I am not Ray Hill. Ray will be back tomorrow because we have yet another execution tomorrow of Billy Galloway, who was the other actor in this crime that Kevin Varga was killed tonight for. It's an interesting and depressing thing that we continue to assume that somehow killing people has some value, given that we've had some, I don't know, between high 400, 500 executions since, what, 1980?
Yeah, I think there's been over 400 since the death penalty was resumed. I think in Texas it was 1982 that it was resumed.
So that's in 8 years, knocking off 50 a year. It doesn't seem that it's had much effect on crime because people are still doing it. So what we're supposed to be learning from this, apparently we don't learn, makes you wonder if it's an effective teaching tool. And given the amount of money we spend for it, each one is over $1 million.
Well,
or more.
The Dallas Morning News says it actually costs three times as much to use a death penalty as opposed to locking someone up for 40 years.
Right, right.
And it's over $2 million.
Well, this has been Execution Watch here on KPFT HD2. And if you're listening on HD2, you're not hearing anything because currently that signal is down. The stream is up, though. No, the stream is up, and after some
fooling around for a month now. We finally got the stream working again perfectly. So the stream is now stable and it does its job. And as always, our thanks to Jim Skelton for his analysis and his support of this process. That voice of experience is really, really valuable, especially when somebody like me, who doesn't know nearly as much as Ray about what's going on, is sitting in this chair. And also Dennis Longmire, who continues to teach criminal justice at Sam Houston State. They're right overlooking the walls. And our producer, Elizabeth Stein, who basically puts this whole show together. So, unfortunately, until tomorrow,